Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today, Governor Charlie Baker announced new efforts to control the coronavirus in five high-risk cities and towns. Governor Baker urged residents to avoid gatherings and outlined new tools for Everett, Lynn, Revere, Chelsea, and Lawrence.
It includes, among other things, advertising on billboards and digital and social media, downloadable materials available in multiple languages, multilingual field teams deployed in these communities, phone and text communications, and outreach to local community groups.
Of those five communities, we want to focus today on Lawrence. The city has the highest unemployment rate in the state, above 30%. Lawrence is more than 80% Latinx, has the highest poverty rate in the state, and is still working its way through the aftermath of the deadly Columbia gas explosion 2 years ago this month. Lawrence is also a vibrant community full of strong multi-generational ties and an active social sector. So with all that in mind, we want to explore how Lawrence is responding to this crisis with some civic and elected leaders. Let's start with Dan Rivera, the mayor of Lawrence. Just earlier, we reached Rivera and asked him how his city is holding up.
It's been really a perfect storm for Lawrence. Either you were part of the workers that had to work during the COVID-19, or you were laid off because you were shut down. Not many of our workers in our city can work from home. Or you were part of the gig economy and you lost those jobs, and or you closed your small business, your family business, which we have a lot of here in the city. And so if not for the work of to get people in food insecurity and try to make sure that people stay healthy, I think it would have been a rougher situation. But like I said, for Lawrence, it's been really a perfect storm.
I'm really sorry to hear that. And it comes on the heels of challenges over time, but right now, highest unemployment in Massachusetts, one of eight communities designated high risk. And on top of that, your city was in the midst of recovery after the Merrimack Valley gas explosions. Only 2 days ago, Governor Baker terminated the state of emergency in response to that, almost 2 years after the tragedy. As the city's elected leader, how do you begin to think about recovery? Where do you start, and what's your top priority right now?
Yeah, well, the silver lining about having come out of the gas crisis to today is that there was a bit of muscle memory still on how to react to helping people and how to react to the tragedy that is COVID-19. We were able to stand up a relief effort and really get to the bottom of how to help people every day. And so that's the silver lining. But, you know, I think we've got to focus on the important things, focus on the public health numbers, focus on testing, focus on controlling the spread and public health education for people. Because of our density, I think it is a place where the virus can spread. And so that is not helpful. And I think that's a characteristic of all of us that are in the top five. It's not something specific to our population. It's just the environment in which we live.
To that point, in his noontime press conference today, Governor Baker announced the launch of the COVID-19 Enforcement and Intervention Team, which he says will take a, quote, more aggressive approach, unquote, in partnership with local officials and communities, including Lawrence, to counter the spread of COVID-19. That includes online toolkits, multilingual field teams, phone and text communications. What's your reaction to that news? And were you partnering in advance with the governor on this rollout?
Yeah, we absolutely have been partnering with the governor. If you think about the array of things that he announced today, the enforcement, the outreach, we were really there with him already, with the exception of this new effort they want to do with messaging and more of a media campaign. That is something that we're really excited about because we get to do Spanish language ads to get people to take the COVID-19 fight seriously. But we had already done $300 mask fines. When they first rolled out the red communities, we immediately rolled back restaurant hours to 10 o'clock. We said anytime somebody calls for about a noise complaint, we're going to treat it as a spread event. And by the way, we also procured $1 million to do testing. So we had already been putting some of the toughest sanctions on people who were not doing what they're supposed to do. I think the new tool that we're excited about is the ability to do TV ads to get people serious about this effort.
historically, Lawrence has had an unemployment rate that's about double what the Commonwealth average is at any time. And so in thinking about partnership with the state, about working on pandemic prevention, and eventually we hope for everyone, recovery, what does the economic recovery tale look like for Lawrence? And how much of that has to do with pandemic recovery, and how much of it has to do with larger systemic issues that have been laid bare by this pandemic, but that we need to address as a human community in the Commonwealth now?
If you think about it historically, the number of unemployment seemed like it was always that double the state average. Because we have always a steady stream of newcomers to Lawrence, you know, we call the immigrant city for a reason. And so folks came through all the time. So even if we created 1,000 jobs 1 year, there would be another 1,000 people coming the next year who need a new job. And we'd have to start this cycle all over again. How do we get people trained? How do we get them jobs? And we have a pretty good ecosystem. Now, this COVID-19 has devastated that ecosystem. And then if you add to the fact that we're going to get new folks, new immigrants every year in that number, the gig economy workers who would normally not be in that number, and small businesses, owners of those small businesses who also wouldn't be in that number. So I think that that's why you're seeing such a big number. In the end, if we can get those businesses back on their feet and out of the unemployment column, but in the end, we didn't have enough jobs to begin with. So we're hoping that training, as well as some small business microloans that are available as long-term too, will help deal with this problem.
Do you need more federal aid to be passed? You know, the $600 per week federal unemployment benefit expired at the end of July. Massachusetts is going to start paying out lost wages assistance as part of the pandemic unemployment assistance. That's eligible residents getting additional $300 weekly payments for 3 weeks. But there isn't another bill coming from Congress right now. Do you need to see the federal government pass more aid?
I think that is going to be ultimately very necessary. But I don't think that that's the cure. I think the cure is going to be focused efforts by the federal and the state governments to ensure that the economy can get back on its feet fully. They can throw money at it, and I think money will solve some problems. But the long-term solution here is let's attack this virus to a point where we can get back on the economy back on its feet. Because there is a lot of work out there to be done, but businesses, I think, are still cautious about growing because they don't know what's going to happen next term. But that we've been lacking federal leadership, I think that's an understatement.
What strengths does your immigrant economy and your constant flow of new immigrants to the city bring to you that you can leverage in this moment?
Well, I think the immigrant entrepreneurship, the willingness to hustle and work hard for a day's pay, I think that's inherent. It's what I saw in my mom. It's what I see in workers in Lawrence every day. The immigrant work ethic and the entrepreneurship is what has kept us head above water in the past. I think it's what's going to save us in the future.
In our last 30 seconds or so, Mayor Rivera, what gives you hope right now, and where are you drawing some inspiration and some joy?
I think about, you know, people coming to this country looking for a better life. And even in this pandemic, they're finding some opportunity to have a life that has steady food in it, that has possibility of a job, that their kids are going to get some education, and that in the end, we've been through these things before. The people of Lawrence have shown they have the fortitude to weather it, and mostly because we do it together, and we know that in the end, if we work hard together, that we can get through it.
That's Dan Rivera, the mayor of Lawrence. I appreciate your time today. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Let's turn now to two people who work with organizations in the community trying to fill the gaps. With me is Julia D'Orazio, Development and Communications Manager for Bread and Roses, a soup kitchen in downtown Lawrence. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you.
And also with us is Linda Rohrer, the Executive Director of Mass Hire Merrimack Valley Career Center. Mass Hire is a federally and state-funded network linking workers and employers in Massachusetts. Linda, welcome to you, too.
Good afternoon. Thanks.
So, Linda, I'll start with you. What's the biggest change you've observed in Lawrence since the pandemic began?
Well, for us, before the pandemic, we would see in our office 200 to 400 people walking through the doors daily, people coming in, actually looking for help with their unemployment claims, even though we're not the unemployment office, but we did have staff from the Department of Unemployment Assistance on site who could help with claims. People would be coming in to meet with our counselors, participate in our job search workshops or an employee recruitment. And some would just walk in because they were either looking for a job or they felt they needed training. And now we're not open physically. So we've been doing everything remotely since the beginning of April. So that's really a big change in the way we interact with, with our customers. But, we have been able to ramp up and provide the services virtually. It's been a little learning curve, but we're doing the counseling using phone, Zoom, FaceTime, WhatsApp, providing workshops online using mostly Zoom, both in English and Spanish, and continuing to do workshops to develop job search skills. So
thank you for that, Linda. I'm going to turn to Julia because I want to give her a chance to sort of compare and contrast the changes and the pivots that we just heard from you with what they're experiencing at Bread and Roses. Julia.
We definitely, before the pandemic, were experiencing an increase in the need as far as mostly food support, not just from the gas fires, but from the ongoing housing and opioid crises happening in Greater Boston and Lawrence as well. Upon the pandemic hitting in mid-March, between that time and the time that we had to close, we were completely overwhelmed with an increase, especially for pantry orders during that time. So yes, we can definitely vouch that the need was immediate and real.
The two of you have both had to change the way you do your work. And I wonder, do you feel like you can reach as many people? You're not distributing from a central food pantry, Julia. And Linda, you already told us you've had to pivot and go online. Is it enough? Can you, or does it scale you back to have to change the way you're delivering your services? Linda?
So, I'd say that, for some people, virtual works. They're comfortable with technology. They've got what they need as far as equipment and an internet service. And so in that way, for some people, I think we're increasing our reach. But others obviously don't have computers and aren't tech savvy, but they have cell phones. So we've been figuring out how we can use them for counseling. So I think, we're able to expand our reach somewhat using, virtual ways of reaching people. But I think for the people that either are limited English speaking or are just not comfortable with technology, that, it's an issue. We're a people-facing business, and I think that in-person interaction is really important in helping people achieve the best outcome.
Is that true for you too, Julia?
Yes. Well, Bread and Roses' whole service model is built around providing services in real time, mostly through a walk-in basis. So we've definitely had to pivot how we do things. In lieu of providing, for example, pantry orders upon request, we're focusing on our community food outreach program, which delivers thousands of food to agencies across Lawrence on a daily basis, to agencies that serve, vulnerable populations, including the homeless and immigrants, seniors and veterans. So, we right now we are 100% expanding this program in order to kind of make up for the limitations of not having our actual doors open at this time.
One of the many things that is scary about this pandemic is the uncertainty. And you are both focused, your organizations are focused on helping people survive and eventually thrive. What about your organizations? We don't know how long this is going to go on. Are your organizations going to survive this?
Well, as far as the Career Center, I have to say it's stressful to, not be able to, meet with people in person. I think we're learning new ways of doing business, though. And in some ways, there's a little bit of a, silver lining to this, and that with the addition of some of the tools that we're using, that will, you know, be something that we'll, you know, we'll use in the future. And I think that, I mean, we will survive. So, and maybe we'll improve a little bit what we're doing, but I have to say, I think we're really anxious to get back and into the office and be with people one-on-one.
As far as Bread and Roses is extremely lucky. We've been around for 40 years and, you know, we are community driven and have passionate investment from so many community groups across Lawrence and the Merrimack Valley. And, you know, it is, however, disheartening that our volunteers are unable to, you know, stay engaged on a daily basis and, you know, working with the guests, which is what motivates everybody ultimately. And so that is definitely a challenge. And we miss seeing the people that come in every night for dinner and, you know, the whole extended family of Bread and Roses. We definitely miss that. We will get through this. We definitely will be expanding our capacity at the end of this pandemic.
And listen to the both of you. You're so thoughtful about it and you're so measured. And yet in listening to you, I feel this kind of franticness, this kind of urgency in response to what I'm hearing from you. What's keeping you, the community, going? And how can people help?
Go ahead, Linda.
Well, I think, you know, what's keeping us going is knowing that, you know, we're trying to work with the people, the unemployed people that are needing to work to pay their bills and support their families. Yet they're dealing with the fear of COVID-19, worrying about getting the virus and spreading it to their family members. So, you know, we're just pushing on to do what we can to, you know, help people, you know, find jobs. And actually we try to encourage people at this point to even, you know, during the pandemic, if you're not able to actually go out, try to improve your skills. And we're trying to put out whatever we can, either online, mostly online, ways that people can maybe improve their English, can improve computer skills, gain certificates in some ways. So trying to help people become ready for when the pandemic, you know, is less or is over to really re-enter the job market.
Definitely one thing that keeps us going is the knowledge that agencies that are completely open at this time, such as Lazarus Health and Neighbors in Need, you know, are in full court press doing whatever they can, you know, and so it's really incumbent upon us as a member of that community to bridge that gap as much as we can. Also, you know, we've been leading a collaborative effort with agencies such as Lazarus House and Project Home Again to fast track food and other resources to people who need them, kind of, you know, without some of the red tape. For example, you know, empowering pastors of local churches to refer people to services. So, you know, we've kind of jumped in and we're trying to lend our expertise on how to do things creatively and, you know, in the moment to the community. But, you know, doing what we have for 40 years is what motivates us, I guess.
Well, that's a fabulous answer. And that's Julia D'Orazio, Development and Communications Manager for Bread and Roses. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you.
And Linda Rohrer, the Executive Director of Mass Hire Merrimack Valley Career Center. Linda, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Next week marks 6 months since Charlie Baker first declared a state of emergency in Massachusetts in response to the coronavirus pandemic. And as we have navigated through it, we have tried to find occasional moments of joy. And for many, sports can bring joy. And in fact, two Boston teams that would normally be playing this time of year have given fans something to rally behind with their bubble-based playoff runs. So how's that been going? Let's take a couple of minutes and check the score with Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Tiziana.
Gotta admit, I have never before said the phrase bubble-based playoff run, Chris.
You know, it really makes me think of the folks running around a field with those giant inflatable hamster
That's
balls
right.
crashing into each other, yeah.
That's right. But what we actually have is some basketball. And the last time we talked, you talked about the Celtics taking on the Raptors, who are the defending champs. That series had a delayed start after the league paused to focus on racial justice after the shooting of Jacob Blake in Wisconsin. It's going now. So how's that series going?
Well, so far, so good for the Cs. They're up 2-0 right now. Game 3 is tonight. Tip-off's around 6:30 or so. And you mentioned this is a challenging series for them. Toronto's the defending champs. They did admittedly lose Kawhi Leonard, who was arguably the best player in the league in the offseason. So it's not the same team that it was last year. But the Celtics have really looked good so far. I mean, they're playing great team defense. You've got young guys stepping up and chipping in. You know, when Gordon Hayward went down, there was some concern. Would they have enough scoring? But really, you've got everybody kind of doing their part. You've got Jaylen Brown has been consistent. Jason Tatum is just electric. And even Marcus Smart has chipped in with some scoring and is always a hard-nosed defense. Really, they've got guys to fill every role, including Kemba Walker, the newcomer, who's really a great big shot guy coming down the stretch. In game two, he was 0-for-7 from three-point range and then fires up a three with a hand in his face with about 2 minutes to go and just nails it, just ice-cold blood in his veins. Love to see what this team is doing right now.
Bring us some sound from that game, Chris.
Well, so it was really a toss-up. I say the Celtics are up 2-0, but game two was a real back-and-forth affair here. And really, I mentioned Marcus Smart scoring. It came down to a huge fourth quarter from him. Here he is hitting his fifth three-pointer in the fourth quarter.
Tatum, nice pass. Smart launches. Oh, it's good! And a foul! Marcus Smart is owning the three-point line tonight. He's got 5 triples in the quarter.
5 threes in a quarter. That's what we refer to as a scoring barrage, Tiziana. You know, I got to say, what I really love about a 7-game series is the chess match. And we've already seen a little bit of that in this series. Game one, you've got Jaylen Brown playing just fantastic defense against Pascal Siakam, the Raptors' best offensive threat. And so Toronto responds in game two by having Siakam bring the ball up the court, gives them a little more flexibility, some more options, and their offense does seem to be in a better rhythm. So it'll be interesting to see throughout this series the adjustments that get made, the matchups, how those play out. And there's also a little bit of gamesmanship. I have to play a little sound for you here, Tiziana, of Toronto coach Nick Nurse, who basically lit up the refs after their game two loss on Tuesday. And here he is talking about Jason Tatum's 14 free throw attempts.
The only frustrating part about it is he shoots 14 free throws, which is as much as our whole team shoots. That's the frustrating part. I mean, I think our guys were working hard on him and we were doing a pretty good job. He did make some good shots. They were obviously getting him the ball a lot, getting him in space. We could have helped a little bit better here and there, but they took very good care of him tonight.
Yeah, I just don't feel bad for him. Sorry.
You love hearing coaches go against the refs like that. And I will say it's probably going to be costly for him. He should know that. He had to pay a $15,000 fine a couple of years ago for making some pretty strong comments about the refs. But it's one of those things. It's like any little advantage you can get. If they get one call, maybe something seeps into the subconscious of one of these refs and they get a call down the stretch, you just never know what could swing the balance.
Well, the Celtics have been so exciting. I wouldn't bet against them right now. We've only got about a minute or so left, though. And something bad happened this week, too. So why don't you break it to everybody?
Yeah, I knew you were going to make me talk about this. The Bruins season is officially over. Ultimately, they just ran up against a better team in Tampa Bay. We talked about Tuukka Rask, their number one goalie, leaving the bubble for family concerns. Nobody begrudges him that. But I think that just presented too much of a challenge for them to overcome. And Tampa Bay is a really good team. It's 2018, they had the same thing. Bruins won game one. Tampa Bay sweeps the next four and knocks them out. So I have to say they showed some real grit. They sent game five into a double OT. It's really easy to roll over and give up when you're trailing in an elimination game. So I do love to see that. And I have to say, bring back Zdeno Chara. Please bring him back. We can get into that.
Well, okay. So years ago in the innocent times before the pandemic, you told me I was going to love this team. Now I'm hearing this may be the end of this team. What does that mean?
Well, we know the window is closing. This is a team that has really come close a couple of times. They won the one cup in 2011, but a lot of folks feel there's just so much talent on this roster. They really probably should have delivered more than one championship. And I will say that's a very Boston thing to say, right? We're complaining about a championship with a core team. But Zdeno Chara, 43 years old. He spent 14 years with the team. He doesn't want to retire. He says he wants to stay. Bring him back, please.
All right. Well, we will continue to check the score with you, Chris Sidorek. Thanks for today. We'll take the good, the bad, and the ugly, right?
That's right. Go Seas.
Thanks, Chris. Join us now in one of Boston's hidden sacred spaces. Most of us don't know about them, but these places of worship are all around the city. One is the New England Seafarers Mission. It's there for workers from the ships that come to Boston Harbor. Of course, the mission is quiet these days and restricted because of the pandemic. We went there before the pandemic started, though, as part of a series exploring these hidden places of worship in partnership with Brandeis University and Walking Cinema. And over the next 3 weeks, we will bring you to three of these spaces on air and also with interactive 3D models you can explore on your computer or phone. So, go back in time with us, not long ago, when giant cruise ships brought thousands of tourists into Boston Harbor. We join Radio Boston's Walter Wolfman there.
In a small convenience store on a pier that juts out into Boston Harbor, the Reverend Steve Cushing rummages through the shelves. He's making sure his shop is ready to take on the oncoming rush of cruise ship workers.
We've got clean, brand new underwear and socks for them to use because they're on a ship for 9 months at a time. So at some point in there, you're going to need some to replace some things. We've got vitamins.
The store is part of the New England Seafarers Mission. Shampoos, Reverend raisins, Cushing, the mission's evangelical chaplain, runs the place like a one-stop shop for ship workers. He stocks it with items from all over the world, like Filipino cooking sauce.
This is a favorite saver. It's a seasoning sauce. So, you know, the food on the ship is relatively neutral, culture neutral. So a lot of these condiments go away to kind of bring in a little bit of home back into it.
Cushing calls cruise ships floating cities. They need hundreds of workers to cook, clean, and otherwise help maintain the ship and please its passengers. Few Americans work these jobs. Most of the seafarers come from China, the Philippines, Indonesia, Russia, and Ukraine. So pieces of home on a foreign shore can mean a lot. A worker named Darren picks up some Lego brand sardines, a favorite back home in the Philippines. He says the store supplies things he can't get on board.
We are needed, especially medications, local food back homes, and it's very helpful because we are not longer to go far from the terminal.
The New England Seafarers Mission didn't start out as a convenience store. It was founded in 1881 as the Scandinavian Seamen's Mission by a Swedish immigrant and ex-sailor named Olas Olsen. Olsen would row out into Boston Harbor and preach to seamen on their ships. Today, the mission is nearly devoid of religious symbols or obvious spiritual practice. The store is on the first floor, and there's a post office on the second. There used to be a chapel on the third floor, but Reverend Cushing filled it with MoneyGram terminals so workers could send their pay back home. The last holdout is a tiny prayer corner, protected by a wooden screen. But volunteer Ken Hamill says it's rarely used.
It's almost invisible. When you come in, you don't really see it as a chapel, whereas more of the chapel-type things occur in the hallways. Overall, the chaplaincy is a roving chapel, if you will.
Reverend Cushing says in the hallways, workers often approach him about problems on their ships. He says they tell him their wages are sometimes withheld, and medical bills go unpaid if they get hurt on the job.
I've been on ships where there's been medical problems, that they weren't going to get the correct medical attention that they're going to need. The ship was going to try to leave as quick as possible. We were able to intervene with the help of other port agencies, Coast Guard, shipping agents, to kind of hold that ship off until that crew member got that medical attention they needed.
We reached out to the Cruise Lines International Association. The industry trade group couldn't comment on individual complaints, but in a written statement said it fully supports and complies with the Seafarers' Bill of Rights, which sets standards on wages and working conditions. Most of the complaints, though, are about the basic discomfort of life on board. Seafarers say they spend hours on their feet interacting with guests, sometimes with no days off. At night, they sleep in tiny rooms, often four at a time, stacked into bunk beds.
Guests complain about their cabin, so I imagine guests complaining, it's smaller than a guest cabin.
That's Molly, a ship worker from Belize. We're only identifying the cruise ship workers in the story by their first names because they fear retaliation for speaking about their employment. Molly says after a while, life on board can get stressful.
If you don't have a strong mindset, it's very hard. Even with a strong mindset, it's hard. But if you have a goal, you'll make sure you accomplish that goal. That's all you have to have in mind. Keep your goal and keep focus.
It's these issues, isolation, homesickness, boredom, that Reverend Cushing says he's trying to combat at his mission. Reverend Cushing says he may never talk about God or pray with seafarers, but his time spent with them is spiritual work.
For me, the way that I'm living out my faith and how I feel my calling, it falls under the umbrella of I am a pastor to seafarers. I want to make sure that they get all the help that they need. What they believe is not primary to me. I want them to know they can believe that they're not going to be forgotten.
This is not the sort of ritual support that chaplains did in years past.
Wendy Kadge, a sociologist at Brandeis University who studies religion, says chaplains like Reverend Cushing are evolving to meet the changing times.
Because we're in a different place in the contemporary landscape where more and more people don't belong to congregations, don't have local clergy that they rely on, yet still have the same kinds of existential troubles that we as humans have long had.
So as fewer people seek out traditional churches, the faithful are going out into the world to try to fulfill what they see as God's will.
At least in the United States, when a vessel comes into port, customs and the Coast Guard care for the vessel itself and for the cargo. But no one does any outreach at all to the people on board unless chaplains are there.
It's last call at the mission, and a shipworker named Joaquin hustles to stock up on Spam. He tells me he's grateful for the convenience.
And I love it. If I like to buy something that I'm not kind of able to go out to buy the thing, I'm going to ask the paper and then they have it. Yeah, they have it. I love it.
As shoppers leave, the Reverend Cushing and his volunteers clean up, restock shelves, and close the metal door to the mission. It will reopen when the next ship comes in. Cashier Sherry Spur says she'll be back. Because to her, this seaport mission is church.
We think that we're doing churchy or Jesus-y stuff when we're like singing songs at church. And I'm not saying that's not important. I'm just saying when you look at how Christ lived, this is how he lived. He would be here. He would be here running the convenience store for the seafarers. That's where he would be.
That story from Radio Boston's Walter Wuthman. To explore an interactive 3D model of the Seafarer's Mission, visit radioboston.org. Next week, we'll visit the country's first and oldest airport chapel in the bowels of Logan Airport. You know Margaret Atwood. She's the best-selling Canadian author behind The Handmaid's Tale, now an Emmy-winning Hulu TV series. Atwood is a Booker Prize-winning author, most recently awarded for her sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, The Testaments. Both dystopian future novels center around a theocratic totalitarian regime, which overthrew the United States government and set up their power center in Massachusetts, in the heart of Harvard's campus. We love bringing you great writers when they come or are passing through town. Atwood is taking part in a virtual Harvard Bookstore event for The Testaments tonight, and we are lucky enough that she joins us now. Margaret Atwood, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Such a pleasure.
Oh, it's a pleasure for me, too.
And sorry about putting Gilead right smack in the middle of you, but it was so convenient.
Is that why you did it? Really, why did you put Gilead right in the middle of us?
Okay, I put Gilead right in the middle of you, partly because it's flat. No, partly because the United States, one of its beginnings was a Puritan theocracy of the 17th century, which was centered right there. And you know that Harvard started as a theological institute. So it wasn't liberal arts or anything of the kind, and it certainly wasn't engineering. But that's where it started. And if you stroll around on the campus, you can see John Harvard himself in his outfit. So I did it partly for that reason. and partly because it had a lot of buildings that I could convert into other things. So I'm not very good at just making stuff up. I like to use real architecture.
Well, we're happy to lend you Harvard anytime you need it.
No, you're not. You are not happy. You do not want any bodies hanging off the Harvard wall. And when this book first came out, Harvard was a bit sniffy about it, I have to say.
Well, so it's been a long time now, and I was thinking about that in reading the testaments. These books put New England, which is, as you say, sort of the capital of Gilead, at odds with much of the rest of North America. There's civil war, fighting factions.
There is, and yes. California's hanging out there. It's
holding Texas.
Out. Yeah.
And so I wondered, is New England, the way we're developing our economy, our politics, are we out of pace with the rest of the country today?
Oh, I have no opinion about that. And as I say, I apologize for having done that to you because you're not like that now. but I was a bit tired of people saying it couldn't happen here, so I picked the most unlikely place for it to happen, namely a very liberal educational institution and, you know, Cambridge, home of intellectuals and happy people and Marimekko dress. No, that was then. So it would be very unlikely, you would think, but then you look back at Germany and see how quickly, once Hitler had got his hand on the levers of power, how quickly he turned it. So it was a bit of a warning. You think it can't happen here, and then it happens.
I was talking to
somebody in Maine, and I said, how are you doing up there? And they said, oh, well, our COVID rates are pretty low. And I said, why is that? And she said, there's not very many people here.
So that raises like three different things I want to ask you. So the first one is, as I read the testaments, it felt like a critique of the moment, but I also realize Handmaid's Tale was written, you know, in the mid-1980s. So that doesn't mean that you weren't planning for a long time to write a sequel. So what made you decide to do it?
History changed, or I should say the course that we were taking changed. So we had the 70s, we had the 60s, we had the civil rights movement, we had the 70s, we had second wave women's movement, we had changes in the laws, and then the 80s was pushback. So I wrote it in the middle of a pushback decade. But then along came the Berlin Wall coming down, end of the Soviet Union, and that changed everything again. Everybody said, ha-ha, end of history, let's just all go shopping. And people weren't thinking much about politics in that decade. But then what happened? We had 9/11, and that changed everything again. And then we had 2008, and that also changed things. And now we're at another moment of big, big change. But in 2016, you could see the currents. You could see the things that had started to happen in the 80s really having grown. And now we see a polarized America. We see America that it's no longer automatically the leader of the free world. We see America that is somehow shrinking. And that is not good news for the world. It should be a leader.
Are you afraid?
Am I afraid? I'm too old. But if I were younger, I certainly would be. And of course, I'm fearful for younger people. But I myself am going to croak quite soon anyway, so what's to worry?
So I wasn't expecting you to say...
I probably shouldn't say croak. It's rather dismissive.
Well, I think you're allowed to when you're talking about yourself.
Leaving this earthly plane. How about that?
So about that, because I wasn't expecting you to say that. I think you could tell by my response. But that echoes so profoundly, and I won't say who because I don't want to give everything away. Spoiler alert for people listening. One of the key characters in the book who basically says the same thing and gives it as their reason for writing what they do.
One of their reasons, yeah. So what's to lose? You know, what is actually at risk here? It's not the rest of your life when you're, I mean, it's not a looked forward to long and productive life, because you're getting near the end of the string.
I want to talk for a minute about... I'm sorry, I didn't know you were done.
Yeah,
please go ahead.
Yeah, go. You go.
So I want to talk for a minute about women. You know, the staggering oppression of women in the first book, and really the revolutionary power of women, as I read it in the second, that really strikes a particular note in the wake of the hashtag MeToo movement. We have also heard some raise concerns that in the wake of a movement like that, with strong revolutionary women changing things, that there could be a real backlash, a pushback.
No kidding.
What do you say to that?
I say a lot of things to that, but I'm just going to sound a little alert here. There are already double agents online. There was just a news story about them 2 days ago, pretending to be progressive people and coming out with extreme statements in order to scare people. So preparing the ground for, you're going to be taken over by evil communist fanatics, and I only can save you, says somebody else that we won't name. So be alert for that, because that also would be part of a pushback movement. So what was the question? Oh, could there be a pushback? Yes, there could be a pushback, and you're already seeing some of that with COVID, because you're seeing women who can't get out of their homes, basically, and more domestic violence. We're hearing about that already, but that's on the personal level. On the institutional level, we're already seeing right-wing governments rolling back rights for women. So you've seen that in Russia, and you've seen that in a number of countries. And if you want to get the lowdown on it, the organization is called Equality Now, and it is, again, a co-partner in our launch of the Testaments paperback. They were our charity partner for the launch of the Testaments hardback. They're an international organization, and they work on changing laws that are detrimental to women around the world. So they have, whatever there is to be known, they probably know it.
So let's stay on women for a minute. So many powerful women throughout history, good and bad, have never had their stories told. There was a piece of me that was mad at you for making me root for Aunt Lydia in this story.
She's not off the hook, you know. She doesn't get to say, therefore you have to forgive me for all the bad things I did. And she doesn't say that. She knows she's done bad things. And I've been quite interested in people from inside regimes like that who have been part of the regime and who have then changed their minds. They're still stuck with the bad things they did. There's no way out of that. They did them. But they have, some of them show the ability to change directions and try to make some sort of amends.
So what does that mean you think the path of redemption is?
Well, what does redemption mean? Does it mean getting right with your own conscience? Does it mean having other people forgive you? It's actually a term that comes from pawn shops, and it goes way back in a Christian terminology, because Christ is the Redeemer. What does that mean? It means that your soul is in hock, so it's not actually sold to the devil yet, but it's parked in a kind of pawn shop of the soul, and in order for it to get out, somebody has to come in and redeem it, redeem the pledge, because usually you've given that pledge for a loan of money. So in order to get the thing back, your watch or your soul or whatever it is, you have to pay the price plus interest. So the idea of Christ the Redeemer is that he does that for you. So what does redemption mean in the case of somebody like Aunt Lydia? Probably the price that she is paying to get her soul out of hock in some way is telling the truth about what she did and opening up a crack in the Gilead regime by getting that information out, because she's also got a lot of dirt on other people. So she's sort of the J. Edgar Hoover of Gilead.
Margaret, I want to shift gears for a minute and ask you, where is race in your stories? It's such an important, complicated part of America's story.
Yeah. Okay, so in the first book, this was a thoroughgoing, out-and-out white supremacist regime. And they have done to black people what Americans, I'm sorry to say, did to North American indigenous people. So they've marched them on a trail of tears all the way to North Dakota. However, in the testaments, that turns out not to have been a very good choice, because it's quite easy to get from North Dakota into Canada. So some have been able to do that, and therefore they're working against the Gilead regime from the resistance in Canada. And as you know, I don't put anything in these books that doesn't have a precedent in real life. And I was old enough to have known some people in the Polish resistance, the French resistance, and the Dutch resistance. And some of the Polish and French ones, and also Norwegian ones, got to England. And some of them got to Canada. And they worked with resistance movements there. So that is what is happening in the testaments. In the TV show, things are different because Hulu has a diversity policy. So you could not have had an all-white show. It's against their policy. So they wrote the script so that the cast is multiracial, which means that the white supremacism of the regime in the book it's not foreground in the way it is in the book.
We're running out of time here, but
that's TV.
Yeah, that's right.
But Bruce Miller also said it would have been very boring to see a show with nothing but white people in it.
You know, well, and it's certainly not a boring show. So in our last minute or so, I don't want to spoil again anything for anyone. Aunt Lydia is a narrator. The theocratic Gilead regime eventually collapses, which we sort of already know from The Handmaid's Tale.
We knew that from The Handmaid's Tale because it's in the afterword, but we didn't know how.
In our last minute or so, is there a message of hope in here?
Oh, I would say so. So power doesn't always corrupt, absolutely, number one. Number two, these kinds of regimes tend to fall in on themselves eventually. And in the 20th century, we saw a number of them doing that. And we also saw what happened to a lot of statues in the 20th century. This testament begins with the statue. And statues have been a motif in real life recently, but I'd already written that part.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. Margaret Atwood is the best-selling author of numerous books, including the Booker Prize-winning sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, The Testaments, which is now available in paperback. She'll be at a virtual Harvard Bookstore event tonight. There's more information about the event and the book at our website, radioboston.org. Margaret Atwood, thanks so much for giving some time today to Radio Boston.
And thank you, and good luck with everything.
Appreciate it. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.